This is the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris, filling in for John Carney today. My next guest is one of the world's best war photographers. She has taken pictures in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Darfur, in the Congo, in Libya, pictures that have shown up on the front page of the New York Times and in National Geographic and Time Magazine and lots of other places. She has won a Pulitzer Prize and a MacArthur Genius Grant and now writes about her life in a book called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Lindsay Addario, welcome to the Big 550.
Thank you for having me.
I told you just before we went on today that I happened to have gotten your book out of the library last weekend, and I was fascinated by it, and the photos are fantastic, and I'm so happy to have you on here today.
Thank you.
Do you specifically refer to yourself as a war photographer, or are you a photographer who's covered a lot of wars?
I never really refer to myself as a war photographer. I actually say, yes, I'm a photographer who's covered a lot of wars. I say I work primarily in conflict zones, and I'm drawn to the stories on the margins of war, actually.
We're going to get to the details of some of the wars that you've covered, but I'm very interested in process. And I'm curious, what makes covering a modern war different?
Huh, that's interesting. I don't know, because I have no point of reference. I wasn't around in the wars that I guess weren't considered modern. So for me, it's always been about being either with the troops on the ground in bases across Afghanistan or Iraq, or it's been about trying to cover the civilian side. So really, in many of these instances, we're going on foot patrols, we're going house to house on searches, we're sometimes engaged in gun battles. For me, it's just about being there and being close to the fighting, if that's what I'm looking for. In other instances, it's about being with the civilians.
Well, I ask because I interviewed a photographer years ago who spent a lot of time in Vietnam, and he said it was, you know, an adrenaline-soaked adventure, not just actually taking the pictures and being with the troops and photographing war, but trying to get the pictures back to wherever it was going to be published, whether it was film that was going to be on TV or film in those days that was going to be on the front page of a magazine or a newspaper. How do you get photos back to whoever's going to use it? How do the pictures get to your editors from wherever you are?
So I travel with a satellite dish, actually. I have my own BGAM, which is a kind of, it's about the size of a laptop, and it goes in my pack, and I have digital cameras, and often I am filing from the field or from wherever it's safe enough to file from. So in some instances, it was, I remember filing from underneath a Humvee. So I was, it was during the first siege of Fallujah, and we were on the perimeter of the city, and there was fighting raging all around us. And I wanted to get the pictures out by deadline to the New York Times, and the only sort of safe-ish place to do that was lying underneath the cover of an armored Humvee. And sending the pictures out, my satellite dish was out, exposed to the sky, and I was hiding. But in other instances, it's not half as dramatic. It's just a matter of going out, doing a day with the troops, sometimes a patrol, visits to homes, and then going back to the base and filing from there.
When you're out in the field, you're often with other photographers and other reporters, sometimes the reporters who are covering the story that you're taking pictures for. How much of your job is to help them write that story rather than just take the pictures? Are you asking questions? Are you sharing stories?
Well, I'm not, you know, most of the reporters I'm with are excellent and in their own right, and they certainly don't need my help, but we often work as a team, and I think that's the ideal situation if I have sort of a partner and she helps me or he helps me get good photos by tipping me off to certain things that they might have heard in an interview, and I do the same in terms of, hey, I just picked up on this, maybe you should ask questions about that. So it's really a partnership. And yeah, I definitely ask questions very often, and I do my own interviews if it's not interfering with the work of my colleague. because I want that information as well for the photographs. I think that it is important to take the photo, but it's also important to make sure I have all of my facts right.
You've got to develop the context.
Of course, and I think that is a fundamental part of the work I'm doing, and especially when I'm working with National Geographic, for example, where often I'm in the field alone, and I have to be both a reporter and a photographer.
Are you competing with or cooperating with other photographers in the midst of a war?
I tend to cooperate with them because I think that we're all in it together. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to compete when you're on a front line because ultimately each one of us is going to get a slightly different image. And it's sometimes it's just nice to have colleagues around, and I think that we look out for each other. So I always feel like it's good to be generous with information, helpful towards colleagues, and I think that that's something that's very important.
You write in your book, quote, "While covering war, there were days when I had boundless courage, and there were days when I was terrified from the moment I woke up," unquote. Will you share with us one of those days you were terrified?
Well, there have been a few, unfortunately. There are times when sort of I get premonitions or I just have a feeling that's unsettling, and I have to listen to that because it's one of the only things that I have when I'm covering conflict. And for example, that is in reference to Libya, and I had been working on the front line for about 2 weeks with several colleagues and other photographers, and on that particular morning on March 15th, I woke up with this very uneasy feeling, and I was sort of paralyzed by fear the entire morning. It was uncanny. And in fact, about 2 days before that, I was so convinced something was going to happen that I gave a hard drive of all of my images to date to Brian Denton, who is a freelance photographer for the New York Times, and I said to him, look, if anything happens to me, please make sure that at least my images are saved and that these images make it to my agency, which was 7 at the time. And so on the morning of March 15th, I woke up and I was working with Tyler Hicks, a great photographer for the New York Times, and we had met up with Anthony Shadid and Steve Farrell, two correspondents for the New York Times, and we were sort of making our way around the town, the city of Ajdabiya, and Gaddafi's troops were moving in fairly quickly from the west towards the east, and we knew that the city was going to fall, that it was pretty imminent, and we sort of pushed the boundaries on how long we wanted to stay because we wanted the freshest reporting. And I had an uneasy feeling all day, and in fact, in the end, when we started pulling east towards Benghazi, we ran into one of Gaddafi's checkpoints, and we were held hostage for a week. So that was a situation in which I had this feeling and something happened, but that's not always the case.
How hard is it, as a woman doing this job, to handle life in countries where women are often considered second-class citizens?
Well, it's not hard, actually. I think I try to use that to my advantage. I think often people underestimate me when I go to certain places. And I think also, I move around under the radar a lot, and I have access to women. So it's not necessarily that they're second-class citizens, but their lives are very segregated from men. And so often I find that I have access to men and women as a female working in these places.
So you didn't run into what Lara Logan ran into in Egypt, clothes torn off, body pawed by people in a crowd or anything like that?
Well, I mean, in Libya, while we were held hostage for 7 days, I was certainly groped repeatedly by many different people who are our captors and people we came across, and I was bound and blindfolded over that time. So it was terrifying, but no, I did not go through anything as extreme as what happened to Laura and as devastating as what happened to Laura. I think I've definitely been in situations where I've been groped or I've been touched by men in crowds, and that is something that does happen. But that also happens in America. I mean, it happens around the world, and I think that it happens more so when I'm a woman working in a man's environment. For example, in Pakistan, where there are not many women doing this kind of work, and there certainly aren't many Pakistani women doing this kind of work. So, of course, men think, well, she's fair game because she's in this sort of man's world. But I think it's important to look at the circumstances as well.
It's the Big 550 KTRS, Paul Harris talking with Lindsay Addario, combat photographer extraordinaire, whose new book is called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. You mentioned earlier that you have been to Afghanistan and many places and had a real connection with the women there. And you write in the book about going to Afghanistan before 9/11, before the U.S. was at war with Afghanistan, when the Taliban controlled that country and someone urged you to go there and take pictures of the women there and try to help tell their story through photos. When you went there yourself, were you treated as the women there are treated or were treated?
No, I mean, it's a very unique experience being a foreign journalist, because we are treated sort of almost as a third sex. Like, we have access to women, we have access to the men, but people can't really place us because our values are different from their women. We're working in many situations where women are not working. So I'm treated as a journalist. I'm treated as someone who has come to do a job. And so in Afghanistan under the Taliban, I was able to move around with UNHCR and with a small landmine organization and with a local journalist, and we moved around outside of Kabul and inside of Kabul, and I was able to surreptitiously take photos because photography was illegal at the time.
Mm.
Photography of any living thing was illegal. So I snuck into women's hospitals. I went into places, women's homes, places that were primarily dominated by women, because I found very quickly that as a woman, I had this great access that my male colleagues didn't have, and that perhaps many people around the world weren't seeing, because there weren't many female journalists going to Afghanistan at the time. So I was treated with great respect by other women. The Taliban treated me with the same sort of with the same treatment they treated other foreign journalists who managed to get a visa. They did not want anything happening to foreign journalists on their watch, because they wanted to prove that they had brought stability to Afghanistan. So for me, it was really about they asked me to go stay in a hotel, and they provided me with a government minder, someone who accompanied me everywhere, and reported back to the Taliban ministry what I was doing.
So you did not have to wear a burqa?
I did not wear the traditional blue burqa. I was very modestly dressed and wearing the Pakistani-style shalwar kameez with my, basically my face covered, my eyes were showing.
So how would you get into women's homes and take pictures of them surreptitiously? Obviously, they must have known you were doing that, but how do you do that with a government minder by your side?
Because the government minder was a man, so he can't go into personal homes as per the norm. So often I had him come to the door of the house with me, and then I would knock on the door and go inside, and he had to wait outside. So often I had connections through the United Nations. I was meeting with professional women who were educated and who had studied and were relegated to lives at home because of the Taliban. So they were very eager to tell their stories and to talk about what was going on. And very interestingly, they were open to being photographed, because more often than not, those pictures never made it back to Afghanistan, because there were no newspapers and there was no television underneath Taliban rule.
So were they desperate to have their story told to the world?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't know if desperate is the right word. I think they really did want people to see how they were suffering. Yeah, and they were people who felt like they had lived, you know, they had lived before Taliban rule, and so they really wanted to show how their lives had changed.
Through your lens, have you seen anything getting better in any of the countries that you have visited?
Certainly. I mean, I, you know, if we look at Afghanistan today, it is still rife with violence. And, of course, we just saw tragically last week a woman was publicly killed and beaten and stoned to death and set on fire in downtown Kabul, which is it is just devastating. But we do see a generation of young women who have been educated. There are women doing sports. There are women in parliament. There are women working. So all of those are, of course, great strides that the country has made. But at the same time, we do still see extraordinary violence against women. And so I think, you know, we have to look at both sides. I wish that I could say there have been many more improvements, but I think the country still has a long way to go.
One of the devastating chapters in your book has to do with the battles in Darfur that you witnessed, and there are photos of horrors that, frankly, seeing even your pictures made my stomach upset. I wonder how you, at what point did you, if possible, become immune to the ravages of war and the horrors of man?
Well, I've never become immune to it, and I make it a point not to become immune to it. I think it's very important to recognize that these are horrible things, and I never want to become so jaded that I stop recognizing that. So clearly when I'm out there doing my work, I have, you know, I have a job at hand, and I have to stay focused, and I have to make sure I tell that story through my lens as accurately as I can. But at the end of the day, of course, I sit with those images in my head, and I think about what I'm seeing, and I take that home with me, and I don't want to forget those images, because part of my work is getting them out there and talking about what I'm seeing and making sure that the world does not forget what's happening around the world.
Since you have been to so many of these places and are now a mom yourself, you continue to do your job, but I'm curious whether you want your child to do what you've done.
Well, I can't really say that. I mean, he's 3 years old.
It's a little early to pick up a camera?
Not too early to pick up a camera. He has a little Polaroid of ours that he runs around with sometimes. But it's certainly too early to predict what he'll want to do with his life. I think that I will, I hope to encourage him the way my parents encouraged me to follow my dreams and to do what I believe in and to do it passionately. And I think that that is perhaps one of the most selfless, most difficult things as a parent to do, is to just let your child be the person he or she wants to be.
Yeah, but I've been in the radio business a long time, and from birth I urged my daughter not to follow in my shoes, and she hasn't.
I would never do that. I honestly think that if he felt strongly about wanting to be a photographer or a journalist, I would encourage that.
So you get a phone call one day in 20 years, hey, Mom, I got a flak jacket and a helmet, and I'm going to any whatever he names, you'd go, I'm proud of you, good for you.
I would only be a hypocrite if I tried to stop him, right? I mean, how dare I do that when my parents, they just sort of enabled me to be and empowered me to be the woman I am.
What's the most beautiful thing you've seen through your lens? We talked about all these horrible things. Tell me something that you took a picture of that you were awed by the beauty of.
God, that happens all the time. I mean, sometimes it's hard to articulate. I mean, sometimes it's just the light or the people and the generosity and the resilience of people. And I often see people who have nothing offering me their last piece of food or their last cup of tea. Those are things and moments that are incredibly beautiful. And I think, for example, in Libya, when we were on the front line, families were giving up their homes to the journalists because they really wanted the war covered and the uprising covered. And so we, 17 journalists, we were sort of crashing on the floor of this family house in the town of Brega. And it was set back a little bit from the front line. And we would go out and work from early in the morning and come back, and everyone would be sort of sprawled out trying to file their pictures. And every night at the door, about a 10-year-old kid would come and knock at the door and walk in with trays of food for us that the women and his family had prepared for the journalists. And, I mean, those moments are unforgettable.
In your everyday life, when you're not covering a war, you're not covering a story for one periodical or another, do you take your camera with you always because you don't want to miss a shot?
Well, I have a point-and-shoot that I carry with me, but I don't actually shoot when I'm on vacation. I always have a camera just in case something happens, but I don't really shoot when I'm not on assignment.
A professional photographer has no vacation photos?
Not really. My husband takes them. I'm not. When I am not on assignment, the last thing I want to do is photograph. I hate to say it, but it's true.
Well, I can understand it, not just because you do it for a living, but because of the times you've had to pick up that camera. You've seen so much ugliness through that lens.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable story. The book is called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Lindsay Addario, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you so much for having me.